Today at Reader's Corner, Nathan Robinson, co-author of the new book, The Myth of American Idealism, How U.S. Foreign Policy Endangers the World. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Surveying the history of U.S. military and economic activity around the world, our guest today, Nathan Robinson, and his co-author, Noam Chomsky, offer a timely and comprehensive critique of unchecked U.S. power. In their new book, The Myth of American Idealism, How U.S. Foreign Policy Endangers the World, they argue that national myths about spreading democracy have led to repeated disastrous wars and are driving us closer to wars with Russia and China that imperil humanity's future. Nathan Robinson, an author or editor of 10 books, is also the editor of Current Affairs and a political columnist at The Guardian. Nathan Robinson, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Hey, nice to be with you, Bob.
Nathan, it was a delight. Well, sometimes it wasn't a delight, but yeah. it was important to read this book and to see where American policy has gone wrong. I wish every history course, whether it's high school or college, could have as an addendum your book that helps explain what really happened and what really went wrong. And I highly recommend this book to our listeners. We're not going to be able to cover every aspect of recent history that you have in your book, but we're going to cover some of the most important ones for sure. I want to start by quoting the jacket cover of your book. Chomsky and co-author Nathan Robinson vividly trace the way the American pursuit of global domination has wrought havoc in country after country without ironically making Americans any safer. And what I thought of as I read that is that Donald Trump in his first campaign for president attacked President George W. Bush for sending young Americans to an Iraq war we should not have waged. He also criticized Western European countries for not paying their fair share of NATO funding. You address NATO funding in your book also. And in his second run for office, he tells the American people he's going to take care of Russia's war against Ukraine in a day. Obviously, those critical of him because of what appears to be a close relationship with Putin wonder what that's going to look like. I guess my point is that there are some things that Donald Trump has either said or done that seem to jibe with some of the concerns expressed in your and Chomsky's book about American foreign policy. Could it be that there's an unusual meeting of the minds here?
I would hesitate to accept that characterization. What I think is that Donald Trump is a canny politician. I wrote an article about this during the campaign called What Donald Trump Understands About War. And essentially what Donald Trump understands about war is that the American public is tired of and does see that a number of the wars that have been waged by this country in recent years in Iraq and Afghanistan have been catastrophes. And because he understands public opinion, because he's very deft at molding himself to fit what an audience wants, he uses a lot of anti-war rhetoric. He's not necessarily an anti-war president. He wasn't. In fact, he was very militaristic in many ways. But, you know, after the Vietnam War, there was this thing called the Vietnam syndrome. We'd seen what happened in Vietnam. It was so horrendous that the public was very reluctant to support future wars. Well, we have a similar thing in the decade or so after the Iraq War that we might call the Iraq syndrome, which is that having seen the catastrophe in Iraq, the reverberations of which are still being felt. We just had a terrorist attack here in New Orleans, right by the Current Affairs offices, by someone who was inspired by ISIS. ISIS being one of the hideous outgrowths of the long-term terrible consequences in the region of the original U.S. invasion of Iraq. People understand that we destabilized and destroyed the region, and Donald Trump knows how to speak to that. But it doesn't necessarily mean a policy difference. We highlight that there was a lot of continuities between Democratic and Republican administrations, including Trump.
So you mentioned Afghanistan and Iraq. Let's take those one at a time. Share with us George W. Bush's Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan just a month after 9/11. What kind of weapons were used, and what did those fighting the Taliban, that is Afghans, think of this U.S. approach I mean, didn't the Taliban even offer to get rid of bin Laden?
Yeah, this is really important because I think this is still misunderstood, but it's pretty well documented. After 9/11, Afghanistan was considered, even by Barack Obama, who was an opponent of the Iraq war, Afghanistan was always talked about as the good war, the just war, the legal war, the war that needed to be waged, the war that we should have focused on instead of getting distracted in Iraq. But actually, what Chomsky highlighted at the time and what is compiled in this book is that in many ways, this myth of Afghanistan as the good war is a myth. And you've pointed to a few reasons for that. One of them is that the war was probably unnecessary. We know that the Taliban was interested in negotiations to give up bin Laden. Those negotiations were not pursued. We also know that, as you say, Afghan opponents of the Taliban were horrified by the way that the United States chose to wage war. They were pleading with, we reprint letters from Afghans who were opponents of the Taliban, pleading with the United States government to stop the campaign of the widespread use of firepower and bombing, which they claimed was turning the civilian population against the United States and making it harder to put a government in place that would attain popular support in the wake of the Taliban's departure. So these are facts that really complicate the narrative of Afghanistan as a war where we were pursuing the terrorists who had attacked us and where we were trying to displace a theocratic terror-supporting regime and replace it with a democracy. In fact, the story in Afghanistan, when you go through it, as we do in this book, really does not look very good for the United States. And it's not just that it's a failure, it's also that the things that it was supposedly trying to do were in many ways myths.
And you mentioned the U.S. war in Iraq as the crime of the century in your book. What evidence is there that Bush and Rumsfeld, his Secretary of Defense at the time, were basically lying to Americans about Saddam Hussein having weapons of mass destruction?
Well, there just wasn't any intelligence to support the assessment that Saddam Hussein was a threat to the United States. We know that, first off, the Bush administration essentially manufactured the idea in the American mind that there was a link between Saddam Hussein and the 9/11 attacks. But also, they were fudging and overstating everything that was known about the Iraqi weapons program. In fact, you know, at various points, Bush would just make things up in his speeches about what Saddam Hussein had. They knew very clearly, and we document in the book, that everything that they were saying was pretty ill-founded and shaky. But they chose to present it to the American people as a proven and certain threat, and to do what was called in the Truman years, scaring the hell out of the American people. They scared the hell out of the American people. But we know behind the scenes, we know from the memoirs of people who were involved, that there just wasn't anything to justify the kinds of confident assessments that they were making at the time.
And I think what's so impressive about the research that backs up your book's contentions is where the sources come from. And I think one of the most powerful quotes that I've read regarding the Iraq War, the motives of Bush and Rumsfeld, come from General Anthony Zinni, former chief of CENTCOM, the U.S. Central Command. You quote him in your book, and I don't need the exact quote, but I wonder if you could share with our listeners where he came down on this, because here's a general on the ground who's running the war, and he's got some serious issues with this war.
Yeah, Zinni was asked for his opinion of the motivations of those who waged the war, of the neoconservatives. And he said that basically the attitude of neocons didn't really give a blank what happened in Iraq and the aftermath, that it was about asserting our strength, and the attitude about what happened to the Iraqi people was, in his words, Who cares? And essentially, that's consistent with the facts, right? It's not consistent with the rhetoric. The rhetoric coming out of the Bush administration and the neocons was, we're trying to build a democracy. We're trying to save the people of Iraq from the brutal tyrant that has reigned over them for so long. But in fact, the best way to understand the war in Iraq is not even just that it was a war for oil, but it was a war to reassert U.S. power in the Middle East. As Zinni said, you know, asserting our strength. And once the strength had been asserted in accordance with what Chomsky has always referred to as the Godfather Doctrine or the Mafia Doctrine, that is to say, in the words of the first George H.W. Bush, what we say goes. Once it had been shown that what we say goes and that a leader who was openly defying us, such as Saddam Hussein, would not be allowed to remain in power, then what happened in Iraq after that was not really our business or concern. That's kind of what Zinni's getting at in that quote.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Nathan Robinson, co-author of the new book, The Myth of American Idealism, How U.S. Foreign Policy Endangers the World. Well, let's move to another part of the Middle East. You inform the reader that your book went to press before the Hamas attack on Gaza, but you decided to write a postscript to the chapter on Israel, Palestine, and the U.S. That was written before the attack.
I just need to clarify, that's not quite right. It wasn't that it went to press, it was that Professor Chomsky's health unfortunately suffered a stroke in 2023, so he was unable to complete the chapter. So we had a draft of the chapter, and then unfortunately he was unable to continue working on it, so I had to write the part that was post-October 7th.
So perhaps you could summarize your critique of U.S. policy on Israel, the Middle East, and its impact on Palestinians, and then tell us about that postscript.
Well, in fact, because the central part of our Israel-Palestine chapter was completed by 2023, it sort of ends in 2022, it forms a kind of interesting time capsule of the situation as it stood before October 7th of 2023. You know, we go through the whole history of the region and the history of United States support for Israel. And essentially what we argue is that the evidence shows that the core of the conflict has always been the aspiration to create and maintain a Jewish state in an area that has a substantial non-Jewish population, which has required a system of ethnic hierarchy and subjugation, which has been compared by the major human rights organizations to South Africa under the apartheid regime. Now, that term is controversial, but it's not really controversial in the human rights community, where Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, and Israel's leading human rights organization all use that term apartheid to describe what is happening in Israel-Palestine. And so we really try to draw attention to that core dynamic of where this conflict is coming from. That is to say that there have been aspirations for a long time for a Palestinian state, and we argue that the United States, because it is allied with Israel for a number of different reasons, has thwarted those aspirations while posing as an honest broker. And we even quote U.S. diplomats who basically say, yeah, we're on the side of Israel in the conflict. You know, we kind of pose as neutral, but really we act as Israel's lawyer in the negotiations, in the peace process. And so we argue that the United States has really played a very negative role since the founding of the State of Israel in 1947, because the United States has been unwilling to use its considerable power to try and impose a fair resolution to the conflict that would give sovereignty, autonomy to both of the communities that exist within this small territory.
How did the Biden administration complicate and prevent the cessation of the conflict, as you maintain in your book?
After the October 7th attacks, the Biden administration made a conscious decision that it was going to support what Israel wanted to do fundamentally in Gaza. And what Israel had vowed to do in Gaza was to wipe out Hamas, to eliminate Hamas entirely. Now, Israeli military experts say that this is an impossible goal, that Hamas cannot, in fact, be eliminated. And one of the reasons that Hamas can't be eliminated is for the same reason the Viet Cong in Vietnam couldn't be eliminated. Because when you inflict horrific harm on the civilian population, as you have to do if you're trying to eradicate a guerrilla organization like Hamas or the Viet Cong, what you do is you breed further resentment among the civilian population and then further support for the guerrilla resistance movement. So the elimination of Hamas was essentially an impossible goal without committing genocide, without just wiping out the population, which is in many ways what the United States did in parts of rural South Vietnam and trying to get rid of the Viet Cong. And so the United States committed itself to supporting Israel as it tried to eradicate Hamas entirely, and so committed itself to an impossible goal, to supporting Israel in an impossible goal, a war that was destined to drag out and inflict horrific, horrific harm on the civilian population in Gaza, which is exactly what we see happening. I wrote an article recently for Foreign Policy magazine on the negotiations, the diplomatic negotiations, supposedly, that the United States was facilitating between Israel and Hamas. And what I argue, and what I think is true, is that the United States insisted that it was trying to get a diplomatic resolution to the conflict while knowing that it couldn't get a diplomatic resolution to the conflict unless it pressured Israel to abandon its ultimate goal of continuing the war until Hamas was fully eliminated or exterminated. And because the United States has been unwilling to pressure Israel to modify that goal, the United States has committed itself to endlessly funneling arms to Israel in support of an impossible goal that is only going to result in the further immiseration and destruction of Gaza.
What is the death toll today of those killed in the Hamas attack and those since killed in Israel's continued bombings of Gaza?
The Hamas attack, I believe on October 7th, the final death toll was about 1,200 people, of whom the majority were civilians, although about one third were military personnel. And there's a kind of distinction you can make between the legitimacy of attacks on civilians versus military personnel. So the portion that's on military personnel is more legitimate under international law. Obviously, intentional attacks on civilians are horrifying and illegal. In the response, we don't actually know the death toll. And I recently interviewed a doctor who served in Gaza and who has organized a campaign of doctors and nurses who have worked in Gaza, and they've written open letters to the Biden administration. One of the arguments that they make is that the death toll is much, much higher than the 45,000 that are reported to have died. And one of the reasons it's higher is because there are so many deaths that come not directly from violence, being killed by bombs and bullets, but by you know medical care that doesn't happen for injuries that exist already. Deaths of neglect, and they argue that the correct death toll is well over 100,000. It is very clearly well over 100,000. So we have a 100-to-1, and they they go through pretty persuasively the reasons why that is, and that they think that number is the one we should adopt. And so it's a 100-to-1. So even if you think that 15,000 Hamas fighters or whatever the Israeli military says, if you accept their numbers on how many combatants have been eliminated, the number of civilians have been killed is just overwhelmingly higher in the response. Plus, of course, many more will die in the future from the cascading effects. There's all the children who've been traumatized. There's all the injuries that will result in deaths in 5, 10, 20 years. There's all the unexploded ordnance in the rubble, in the millions and millions of tons of rubble, which is filled with unexploded bombs, which will kill people, as U.S. bombs in Cambodia have been doing for the past 50 years. So the death toll is going to be very, very high when you measure it out over the decades that the war's impact will last.
Moving on to China, you claim that Biden essentially maintained much of Trump's foreign policy regarding China. What did both get wrong?
We don't claim that. In fact, the New York Times claims that. You know, we're quoting right. we're quoting other experts saying, you know, in fact, that there's been a lot of continuity between Biden's attitude towards China and Trump's, which is to say, generally a hostile attitude. I mean, the core of what we argue is wrong is this presentation of China as a threat to the United States. The language of the rising China threat, is very, very common in mainstream foreign policy circles. And we argue that that language is very dangerous because what it causes is what's known in the foreign policy community as it's called the security dilemma, which is where when you have two parties, two countries, and one perceives the other as an aggressor and takes measures that it perceives as defensive, the other party perceives those supposedly defensive measures as aggression. It responds with defensive measures of its own, which are then in turn perceived as aggression by the other side. And so there's this spiral of mutual misunderstanding where each side interprets the other side as making a threat against it and responds with something that that pushes both sides towards war. And we argue that this is very much what is going on with the United States and China today, in that the United States doesn't perceive its actions towards China as aggressive. It only perceives China's actions towards the United States as aggressive. But China sees things entirely differently. So the U.S. will point to Chinese spying, the Chinese spy balloon, for instance, as signs of China's aggressiveness, but without examining our spying that we conduct against China and how it's perceived by them. And we discuss the United States' extensive efforts to penetrate into China and spy on the Chinese government, which, of course, they perceive as an aggressive act. And so we talk about how dangerous this situation in which, instead of talking about how do we dial down tensions, how do we cooperate with this country that is a nuclear-armed country that we need to get along with, that we need to work on a lot of things together, like the climate catastrophe, instead of that, there's a lot of discussion in the United States of how do we prepare for a possible war with China. And when China sees in the United States the people discussing how do we prepare for war with China, they think, oh, the United States is preparing to go to war with us.
And I must say, I went down a rabbit hole in this one, Nathan. I was really interested in your claim that China's nuclear buildup is predicated on how they read U.S. policy. And you actually had a footnote from an article, and I'm going to quote the paragraph and then you can comment on it. In particular, China has been concerned about shifts in U.S. strategy outlined in the Pentagon's 2018 nuclear posture review. Many Chinese experts have noted that the review highlighted China as a strategic competitor and that it argued for lowering the threshold for the use of nuclear weapons, including in response to certain kinds of non-nuclear attacks. They also noted the report's emphasis on low-yield nuclear weapons, which could possibly be used to coerce China. Well, that doesn't sound too much different than Vladimir Putin threatening tactical nuclear weapons in Ukraine. And, you know, we've beat him up on that one. But this one, I have to say, again, I didn't realize this until I read your footnote. Yeah.
Americans don't necessarily read American national security strategy documents, but leaders of other countries do. Yeah. And so they see our threats against them, whereas our population does not see the threats that we make against other countries. It is a fundamental fact of the situation between the United States and China that China maintains to this day a no first use policy on nuclear weapons. That is to say that while they have nuclear weapons, they would never be the first party in a conflict to deploy nuclear weapons. The United States, on the other hand, has refused to ever adopt a no first use policy that would say that we will never be the first party to use nuclear weapons. I think Joe Biden considered it at one point, never adopted it. And it's worth thinking about how that appears to other countries. The United States is a heavily armed nuclear power that in its strategy documents says in particular, we see the rise of China, China's increasing power in the Indo-Pacific region as a threat that needs to be contained. So China understands, by military means if necessary. And so, China understands the implications of that. And so they take actions in response. response, which they perceive as defensive against U.S. aggression. The United States does not perceive what it's doing as aggression. But then you have, as I say, that dynamic of the security dilemma where two perceived defensive acts are perceived as aggressive by the other side, and conflict threatens to spiral out of control because nobody is noticing what is happening in this situation and trying to find ways to dial it back.
Today, I'm speaking with Nathan Robinson, co-author of the new book, The Myth of American Idealism. The book is an indictment of both American foreign policy and the political influence that supports it. Share with us your thoughts on a changing NATO mission and how that eventually becomes a problem for Ukraine, especially NATO's decision to discuss Ukraine's admission to NATO and the U.S. role.
Yeah. So after the Cold War, there was a big discussion about the role of NATO in the world. I mean, NATO was an organization that existed to, you know, its ostensible purpose was to protect Europe against the Soviet threat. But when the Soviet threat disappeared, there was all this discussion about, well, what is NATO for? Should NATO even be disbanded? NATO was not disbanded. In fact, NATO expanded. And this was seen by Russia as a way of trying to contain Russian power and for Americans to maintain strategic power in Europe. And so the Russians have always been very, very suspicious of what NATO was for in the post-Cold War world. Those suspicions were exacerbated during the NATO bombing of Kosovo in the late 90s, which was not approved by the UN Security Council, which the Russians objected very strongly to, saying that it was illegal. And the Russians essentially saw NATO as a U.S.-run intervention force to maintain U.S. dominance in Europe. Now, you can argue whether that characterization is true, but as I've mentioned, it matters how things are perceived. And when there was all this discussion about whether NATO should be expanded further into Eastern Europe in the 1990s, in the early 2000s, there were a lot of foreign policy experts who were warning at the time that if NATO continued to expand, Russia would see this as a major threat. They would react in a very hostile way, that to them it was an issue of national security, and that they would object very strongly, and that the brightest of all red lines was Ukraine joining NATO because of Ukraine's sort of distinct history with Russia, where some like Vladimir Putin even consider it sort of a part or a peripheral part of Russia. And so these kinds of warnings of how Russia would react if NATO continued to expand and offered membership to Ukraine, these warnings were ignored in a mood of post-Cold War triumphalism, in which many U.S. policymakers felt that we had won the Cold War and we were entitled to build whatever security alliances we wanted, and the Russians would just have to deal with it because there was nothing they could do about it. Now, NATO expansion is not the only reason why Vladimir Putin invaded Ukraine. I've mentioned that he also, the imperial motive is not absent. It is certainly true that Putin would love to reintegrate Russian-speaking parts of Ukraine. But it is also true that there were plenty of warnings that if the United States tried to pull Ukraine, and in fact, the political scientist John Mearsheimer warned in 2014 that the United States was leading Ukraine down what he called the primrose path, that by offering them NATO membership but not being willing to fight in a war to protect Ukraine, the Mearsheimer's words were that Ukraine is going to get wrecked, because what he argued was that the United States was provoking Russia and there would be a Russian response, which, would be an aggressive and illegal response, but would nevertheless be a response to actions that were taken by the United States.
Well, many Ukrainians have indeed lost their lives as a result of this war, and it leads many to believe that a negotiated settlement is really the only way to get out of this thing. The Congressional Democrats, I think you refer to a group of Congressional Democrats who called for a negotiated settlement. What was Biden's response to this in the meantime? And then you might also share with us General Mark Milley's response as chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He had his take on a negotiated settlement to the war.
Yeah, it's true. in the early days of the war, unfortunately, the mood that prevailed in the United States was very similar to the mood that prevails in many situations of war, which is that any talk of anything short of absolute victory against the aggressor is capitulation, is appeasement, is apologism for the enemy state, is excusing the enemy state's aggression. And so, as you mentioned, when the congressional progressives, you know, in the early days of the war, the kind of mood prevailed in the United States that prevails in many wars, which is that any talk of anything short of absolute victory over the enemy is a form of apologism, appeasement, capitulation. We can't talk about diplomacy because our enemies are always, you know, the next incarnation of Hitler, and we don't want to do what Chamberlain did at Munich. And so, unfortunately, whenever the issue of, well, how are we going to actually resolve this war was raised, there was a lot of very aggressive pushback from people who said, well, we're not going to resolve it. Ukraine just has to win. We have to give them what they need to win. Victory is how the war will end. The Russians need to be pushed out of every square inch of Ukraine, including Crimea, which needs to be retaken. And in fact, when the congressional progressives, this group of them, released a pretty mild letter that was just encouraging the Biden administration to, quote, make vigorous diplomatic efforts in support of a negotiated settlement and ceasefire, there was a huge firestorm of criticism, including from other Democrats. One of whom said she was dismayed that fellow Democrats think we can negotiate with Putin. And you mentioned Mark Milley there. I mean, he was arguing, he was chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, and he had been arguing that we needed to press Ukraine to participate in negotiations for a diplomatic end. He saw that there was that moment where Ukraine was in a position of strategic advantage. He said, this is the moment that we need to seize in order to have negotiations that are going to perhaps get a favorable settlement to Ukraine. He was overridden, however. His view was not shared by other Biden administration officials who just argued that we needed a military-first solution. We needed to continue arming Ukraine. Unfortunately, it's a real shame that during the period where Ukraine had more strategic leverage in a negotiation before the tide of the war started to turn against it, those discussions about negotiated settlements and solutions were shut down.
Nathan, I knew we'd do it. We wrapped it up here. No time for another question, but I've got lots of them. And that, again, will encourage our listeners to get a copy of this book, The Myth of American Idealism, How U.S. Foreign Policy Endangers the World by Noam Chomsky and Nathan Robinson. Nathan Robinson, thank you so much for writing this book. And thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The audio engineer for today's show is James Baker, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.